from the studios of Kootenai Co-op Radio, this is Deconstructing Dinner.
Welcome to Deconstructing Dinner, a weekly radio show and podcast produced in Nelson, British Columbia at Kootenai Co-op Radio, CJLY. This show is heard on radio stations around the world, including WMRW 95.1 FM, Warren, Vermont. I'm John Steinman. Today marks part two in our series Exploring Ethnobiology. In May of this year, 2010, Deconstructing Dinner traveled to Vancouver Island, where two international conferences on ethnobiology were being hosted. Ethnobiology examines the relationships between humans and their surrounding plants, animals, and ecosystems. Today, more and more people seem to be interested in developing closer relationships with the Earth, and so there's much to be learned from the research of ethnobiologists, and in particular from the symbiotic human-Earth relationships that so many peoples around the world have long maintained. On this part two of the series, we'll listen to segments from a one-on-one interview with Nancy Turner of the University of Victoria. Nancy is perhaps the most well-known ethnobiologist in Canada. I sat down with her in the community of Tofino to learn more about what ethnobiology is, why it's an increasingly important field to pay attention to, and what we all might learn from the many Indigenous peoples that ethnobiologists work with. Also on the show, a recording of a presentation by Cheryl Bryce and Pamela Tudge, who are examining how the Indigenous peoples living in what is now the city of Victoria might reinstate traditional harvesting practices of an important traditional food, camas. On part one of this Exploring Ethnobiology series, we heard from Indigenous youth from Vancouver Island who are seeking to reconnect with their traditional ways of accessing, producing, and conserving food. It was learned that reestablishing or strengthening those connections is much more than just ensuring food security, but is instead a powerful tool to preserve culture and honor the sacredness of our natural surroundings. Nancy Turner is very familiar with the importance of these connections. She's been studying the field of ethnobiology for most of her life. Born in Berkeley, California, Nancy moved to Victoria at the age of five, and she lives there today as a distinguished professor in the School of Environmental Studies at the University of Victoria. She earned a PhD in ethnobotany in 1974 from the University of British Columbia when she studied three contemporary Indigenous groups of the Pacific Northwest, the Haida, Bella Coola, and Lillooet. Nancy's major research has demonstrated the role of plant resources in past and present Aboriginal cultures and languages as being an integral component of traditional knowledge systems. Nancy has also played an important role in helping demonstrate how traditional management of plant resources has shaped the landscapes and habitats of Western Canada. In 1999, Nancy received the Order of British Columbia, and 10 years later, in 2009, received the Order of Canada. She's authored numerous books, including, among others, Food Plants of Coastal First Peoples, Food Plants of Interior First Peoples, Plants of Haida Gwaii, and The Earth's Blanket, Traditional Teachings for Sustainable Living. I sat down with Nancy in May 2010 while we were both attending the 12th International Congress of Ethnobiology held in Tofino, British Columbia.
Well, ethnobiology is really the study of people and the natural world, especially the study of people and their relationships with plants and animals, and especially people who have direct relationships with their surroundings, the plants and animals that grow in their own home places. I've grown up in a family where my dad was an entomologist. He studied insects, and my grandfather was an entomologist, both of whom really encouraged me to study natural history. I always loved birds, and I always loved plants from the time I was, before I was 5 years old. And as I got into maybe 9, 10, 11, I started thinking more about plants that you could eat. I was fascinated that you could eat dandelion leaves, for example, and I would pick them and bring them in and make salads from them when I was just a kid. And I didn't really realize that there was a field that you could actually study that was about all of this, how plants could be used and all of the different knowledge about plants as food or materials or medicine, how to make fiber. That was actually something that you could study. And I first was given two books when I was I think in high school, probably maybe first year university, but by that time I already knew about this field, ethnobotany. There was a book by Erna Gunther called The Ethnobotany of Western Washington, and there was a book edited by Elsie Steedman on Thompson Indian ethnobotany that pertains to the Ntlakatmukh Nation's relationships with plants, mostly of notes recorded by James Tate, who was an ethnographer who lived in that area in the late 1800s and early 1900s. Mm-hmm. When I saw these books, and then I started reading about work from Franz Boas, who worked especially with the Kwakwaka'wakw, then he called Southern Kwakiutl, I decided this is what I wanted to study. And although I went through in biology and botany, I took a course in anthropology and in third year, and my term paper was the ethnobotany of the Southern Kwakiutl of British Columbia. Mm-hmm. And then I did an honors thesis, and that's when I started learning from the Saanich people, so near Victoria, and started to work with elders there like Christopher Paul from Tsartlip. I would go out every Tuesday afternoon in my fourth year in university, and he would teach me as much as I could learn about plants, the Sanchathan names, and all of the importance of them mm-hmm. to their people. Mm-hmm. So that's how I got started, and it's one of those fields where that's endlessly fascinating. The more that you learn about them, the more fascinating and interesting it becomes, and the more you see the importance and relevance of the knowledge of local people and indigenous people in this modern world.
This is Deconstructing Dinner. Within the field of ethnobiology are a number of more specific fields of research, ethnobotany, ethnozoology, and ethnoecology. For a while, Nancy Turner was known more for her work as an ethnobotanist, but today refers to herself as an ethnoecologist. Her reason for the title change demonstrates one example of how ethnobiologists and indigenous peoples learn from each other.
I've been working in this field for over 40 years. I've been learning from especially from Indigenous elders and knowledge holders here in British Columbia over that time. And I've come more and more to recognize that people's knowledge is very holistic, and you can't just separate out plants. Mm-hmm. It's just not possible, because they relate to fish, they relate to the birds, the animals, the fungi, and so forth. More and more that knowledge comes to be reflected in the relationships between people and their whole environments, their movements around the land and their seasonal rounds, and their stories that involve plants and animals and environments mm-hmm. in habitats, mm-hmm. The ways that they have not just sustaining but actually enhancing environments and plants and animals where they live and the ones that they rely on, and the belief systems that help them to manage these other beings, other living beings.
Nancy Turner's comments highlight why Deconstructing Dinner has come to recognize ethnobiology as such an important field to explore, especially today. We've finally arrived at a time of widespread acceptance that, yes, we as humans are having an incredible impact on the Earth, an impact that no doubt has been fed very much by an inability to understand the relationships between all living things. While attending these two international conferences, it became clear that ethnobiology is a field of research that not only studies relationships between people and their surrounding environments, but is too a relationship builder itself, by bringing together many academic disciplines and fields of research. Nancy Turner.
Of course, every single academic discipline can have an aspect of it that relates to this relationship between people, plants, animals, and other living things and environments. So, for example, the most obvious ones would be biology, the study of living things, plants, animals, fungi, and so forth, and anthropology, which is the study of peoples of the world and cultures. But also, you can imagine linguistics would be very important in this field, because are names in all the different languages of the world. There are names and terms that relate to those relationships with plants and animals, to the plants and animals themselves and the places where they live. And so linguistics is an important element. And then you can also think, well, political science even, because it involves relationships of trade and social organization and so forth. And economics, because throughout history, people have valued certain resources from the plant and animal world and have used those to exchange with others. Mm-hmm. And similarly, just about every field you could think of, from education to philosophy and psychology, all relate in some way to ethnobiology.
One of the best examples that I heard on more than one occasion of the importance of the relationships formed between food sources and people is language. While for people of Western backgrounds, food has rapidly become of less significant importance, for many indigenous peoples and some non-indigenous peoples, food is front and center. It's an identification of who they are, so much so that food within many indigenous cultures maintains a pivotal relationship to their language. And so when we speak of food security, we're speaking also of cultural security, the preservation of language.
Oh, there's a tremendous connection there. What's happened in the last 200 plus years since Europeans arrived has been just a cascading effect of so many different impacts on indigenous people's lives and cultures. And some of them, you could say, have been positive. But many of them have not, and have been the colonialism, the enforced schooling in residential schools, and the loss, the alienation of people from their lands has all resulted in that kind of coinciding loss of language and loss of traditional food, a loss of access to traditional food, and loss of the ability to do the activities around the food systems that help to maintain and sustain them over time. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, everything is tied up with language as well. Mm-hmm. And so the place names, if you look at place names here where we are in the Tlaquat Sound, I looked at lists of Nuchanalth names for these places, and so many of them are tied to their food production systems or tied in some way to environments and the weather and the creeks where the salmon are and so forth. If you look at the gazetted names, the English gazetted names for the same places, so many of them are the names of men and ships, I found. Mm-hmm. Mears Island, for example, and there are many others. Mm-hmm. And so that represents a loss of language, at the same time a loss of access to places, and a loss of, in a sense, an erosion of that knowledge. Mm-hmm. But I have to say, it's not gone. It's still there. It's just that it's been so heavily suppressed. And I firmly believe that it's important for all of us to work at reversing that trend. It's taken so many different impacts to bring it to the point where it is now, and I think it's going to take an equal number of positive moves and positive actions to bring it back again. But I believe that it really will come back.
Bringing back that knowledge is a key role played by ethnobiologists, and it's that role that many Indigenous peoples see as being so important. Ethnobiologists can, after all, take that traditional knowledge and communicate it in ways that are more understandable to Western peoples and to Western systems, whether it be marine or terrestrial conservation systems, food systems, transportation systems. The knowledge that ethnobiologists access and share can support Indigenous peoples with their efforts to protect and enhance their traditions and cultures. But it's also through this process of learning about the relationships between human cultures and their surrounding environments that non-Indigenous peoples in what is now called North America can learn a great deal. In the case of food, we are in the midst of a notable local food movement, with peoples in rural and urban communities actively seeking to reconnect with food, and in doing so, reconnect with the earth. As part of my conversation with Nancy Turner, we spoke about what this movement of local food advocates might learn from the research of ethnobiologists and from Indigenous peoples and their relationships to the sea and to the land. We also discussed whether or not the role of ethnobiology has changed in light of this widespread interest of all peoples to reconnect with our food.
I think it has changed a lot. I think for all of us, because of the teachings that we've gained from these really wise and knowledgeable people we've been working with around the world, people who are really grounded and really place-oriented, I guess, and many times very spiritual. I think most of us have become a lot more sensitive to that. And in the past, maybe there was a lot of more of a utilitarian kind of, what can this plant be used for? And the original kind of founder of ethnobotany, the first person who suggested it as a field, John Harshberger, in fact, probably defined it as the uses of plants by primitive peoples. I mean, and that was in the 1890s. Very narrow-minded and racist kind of view of what ethnobotany should be. Mm-hmm. And it was sort of like looking at the old textiles and the old foods and gourds and things that were found in archaeological sites and then figuring out how we can use them today in some way. Mm-hmm. Very utilitarian. And now a lot of us are becoming so much more aware that it's not so much the uses of these plants that is necessarily important, but it's the relationships that we have with these plants that is the most important thing to understand. Mm-hmm. And I think what we're facing in the world today is huge threats to both to people and the environment, the biocultural diversity of the earth. And one of the directions that societies in general need to move in is to become so much more less materialistic and acquisitive. We're taking way more than we should of the resources of the earth. And it doesn't necessarily make us any happier to do that. A small portion of the world, really, population-wise, is co-opting much of the world's resources. And we don't need to do that. That doesn't make us happier. As long as we have our basic needs fulfilled, I think most wise people, the Dalai Lama included, for example, would agree that the satisfaction and joy that we get in living is nothing to do with the material things that we have, but it's to do with the relationships that we have with each other and with the plants and animals and other living beings in our environments. Mm-hmm. And just the pleasure that we get in seeing how it all fits together in this magical world can give us so much satisfaction, joy, and love, and all the fulfillment that we need in our lives. Mm-hmm. We don't need all those things. We don't need to ride around and trash the mountains with our ATVs and all of that stuff, as long as we just have enough.
This is Deconstructing Dinner in part two of our Exploring Ethnobiology series. We're listening to segments from a one-on-one interview with Nancy Turner, an ethnoecologist and distinguished professor at the University of Victoria. I spoke with Nancy in May 2010 while visiting the 12th Annual International Congress on Ethnobiology in the community of Tofino on Vancouver Island. Nancy and I spoke about the role of ethnobiology today and its importance in helping all peoples understand the valuable relationships that we can form with our surroundings, with plants, animals, ecosystems, and more specifically, for those of us interested in deconstructing our dinners, our food. Certainly for those of us interested in better connecting with the origins of our food, new relationships will be established. Perhaps a relationship with a tomato plant, with a chicken, with worms, or with a farmer or fisherman. And it's through these relationships that we become more capable of understanding our footprints, our ecological footprints, our social footprints, economic footprints. And so I asked Nancy Turner if ethnobiology and its study of relationships between people and ecosystems can enhance our concept of what a footprint is.
I think it can, because it teaches us about these natural processes and how to work with them, instead of trying to totally change and manage in a large scale, an industrial scale, our food production systems, for example. A lot of our food can be produced pretty locally without destroying everything by using the natural processes that are available to us, and the concepts of permaculture, for example, which are largely based on traditional farming, agroecosystems, and so forth. Those are things that local and indigenous peoples around the world have learned, that if you try to change, if you try to go against the natural processes, you're going to run into all kinds of problems. You try to channelize the water, you're going to create dry areas in other places, and you're going to create problems for the fish. If you pave over huge areas, you know, you're going against the natural processes that are there for us. If you cut down all the trees, you're thwarting that beautiful process that plants have of eating light and producing all of the like fixing the carbon for us. All of these wonderful species that we live with, they help us, and they serve us. They give us their gifts, and often we don't even see it. We just cut down the trees right away and try and put in something that we think is serving us better. But in fact, if you go to traditional societies and people who are close to the land, they know that you have to respect all of these other life forms. And just by doing that, you're lessening your ecological footprint.
For the most part, those who were attending the two conferences in May on ethnobiology were all studying cultures from the past or indigenous cultures of the present. But what about this rapid emergence of these new relationships with plants and animals being formed by peoples of Western descent? Of course, here on Deconstructing Dinner, we've been tracking this movement for 4.5 years, showcasing the rise of backyard chickens, of urban farming, and of the closer relationships being cultivated with the land that grows our food. But these new relationships being formed were not so present at these conferences on ethnobiology. And I asked Nancy what an ethnobiologist might think about this new local food movement.
Oh, with great fascination, I think. It's important to remember that all of us at some time, our ancestors were living like this. And indigenous peoples and local peoples who have lived in one area for a long period of time have built up these amazing systems. But all in the backgrounds of all of us in the world, no matter who we are, we have this kind of wisdom. And one of the things that ethnobiologists and ethnoecologists really like to study is how this knowledge is acquired and transmitted and adapted, and how we learn from each other, how we exchange ideas. People do that all the time. Indigenous people are always learning new things. It's a very adaptive kind of cultures, understandings. It's never static, but always taking advantage of new ideas that are brought in, maybe taking a new technology and turning it into a different direction for a different species. But that's essentially the kind of thing that's happening now, is that people are doing this and rebuilding and renewing a long existing connections. And so there is a lot of experimental work, but it's a very social kind of thing. It's not just a the mechanical process at all, but there's a social element to all of this practice and knowledge, and it builds alongside of it and with it and integrated with it. And I think it, personally, I think it's helping to build a better and stronger and more sustainable societies to see people really striving to do that and paying attention and caring. That's the word, caring for the other species and for each other instead of being careless and not thinking about them.
Through the efforts of the local food movement to renew these long existing relationships that Nancy speaks of, I asked her what wisdom she would pass along to the local food movement.
Well, one of the things that I think the food movement could look at more is the understanding of these temperate food production systems that we have that work with perennial species mainly. And that don't are not the same as the farming, the agroecosystems further south in subtropical or tropical areas, where you're planting, you are planting the seed and you're plowing the ground. Here, the foods that people relied on are the perennial species, shrubs like the berry bushes. You even eat the sprouts of the berry bushes, and then you get the berries. And even the edible roots that people have used in the past were harvested in a sustainable way, where a selective harvesting system that rotated over several years. So that's one of the lessons, I would think, that you looking at the way people use small-scale fires to maintain open clearings and edges that are productive for berry bushes, and working with multiple cropping systems that are different in different places over time. I think, again, the principles of permaculture actually do reflect many of the practices and processes that people have used here in food production. And I think rather than just creating square fields where we plow the ground and plant more seeds of cabbages or whatever, that we could do more and diversify our food production systems and have those wetlands and ponds that create habitat for birds and insects as well as for people. And there's a lot of good examples. Farming in Nature's Image is a book that's very good for that.
Nancy Turner has been studying indigenous foods for 40 years, and with all of the wisdom that she has to now share, I also asked her about her own personal practices and how she has applied the knowledge that she's learned in her own life.
If you come to my house, and I hope you do sometime, we have a garden. It doesn't produce all the food we need or anything like that, but to me it's a garden that, if everybody had a garden like that in Victoria, it would be a much more diverse and rich, biologically and culturally rich place. That's what I guess what I've done for the last quite a few years now, is to just try and increase diversity in the world, create small wetlands, replant plants that used to be there, and in my own yard try to reflect that philosophy, as well as in my work at the university. We now have really a wonderful philosophy of planting more native plants around every new building that we have built in the last couple of years at the university has been landscaped with native plants and has roofs of native plants. And I think if we can shift our way back to away from this kind of green monoculture that we seem to almost worship in parts of cities and in North America, especially the lawn, the American lawn, which is after all mostly introduced species and monoculture and not very biodiverse and not very culturally interesting to me. If we could just get away from that and start to restore some of those wonderful complex habitats, I think it would make a big difference. And I'll just tell you a quick story. we decided to put a pond in our front yard. My grandson and my daughter and son-in-law got a pond form, and they dug a big hole and they put it in. And my grandson said to my daughter, "We did very well, didn't we, Mom? We should call this the Very Well Pond." So this is the Very Well Pond in our front yard, and I was so thrilled. Within hours of filling, there was damselflies around it. Mm. Within a couple of weeks, there were frogs singing all around, and we have a lot of frogs in our yard, and I look on tree frogs as being one of the symbols of a healthy ecosystem. Mm-hmm. And you see dragonflies, and we also have a lot of native plants, salmonberry and camas blooming, and cattails and wapato in the pond, and it's just a real thrill to just to be there and see the life that is there just because of a few simple things that we did. Mm-hmm. We didn't have to do much, but working with natural processes is just a wonderful way to go, I think.
This is Deconstructing Dinner in part two of our series, Exploring Ethnobiology. Ethnobiology is the scientific study of dynamic relationships between peoples, plants, animals, and environments from the distant past to the immediate present. In May 2010, Deconstructing Dinner attended two international conferences on the subject held on Vancouver Island. This series will feature recordings from those conferences and will include interviews with ethnobiologists from around the world. The series is archived online at deconstructingdinner.ca. On this part two, we're listening to segments from an interview with well-known Canadian ethnoecologist Nancy Turner of the University of Victoria. Born in Berkeley, California, Nancy moved to Victoria at the age of five, and she lives there today as a distinguished professor in the School of Environmental Studies at the University of Victoria. She earned a PhD in ethnobotany in 1974 from the University of British Columbia when she studied three contemporary indigenous groups of the Pacific Northwest, the Haida, Bella Coola, and Lillooet. Nancy's major research has demonstrated the role of plant resources in past and present Aboriginal cultures and languages as being an integral component of traditional knowledge systems. Nancy has also played an important role in helping demonstrate how traditional management of plant resources has shaped the landscape and habitats of Western Canada. We'll hear from Nancy Turner later on the show, but first, let's hear from one of Nancy's students, Pamela Tudge, who, along with Cheryl Bryce, a Lekwungen woman, shared their work at the 12th International Congress on Ethnobiology. Their presentation was titled Lekwungen Camas Harvest, Reinstating Indigenous Food Practices in an Urban Landscape. Their presentation was one of many recorded by Deconstructing Dinner that demonstrated the importance of ethnobiology in helping protect, restore, and enhance the relationships between all peoples and ecosystems. Also known as the Songhees, Lekwungen peoples are an indigenous Coast Salish peoples whose territory includes what is now the Greater Victoria area on southern Vancouver Island. Cheryl Bryce is the Lekwungen Land Manager, and Pamela Tudge is a graduate student in the School of Environmental Studies at the University of Victoria. Alongside their advisors, John Corbett of the University of British Columbia and Nancy Turner, they're in the process of examining how to go about reinstating Indigenous harvesting practices in an urban setting, which in this case is the City of Victoria. They looked into what alliances are necessary to form, and they investigated what Indigenous food sovereignty looks like in that urban setting. Here's Cheryl Bryce.
But as Pam was saying, in the Victoria area, this is all of our ancestral homelands, what's now known as Victoria. And Lekwungen is the major seven family groups that make up this area as our ancestral lands here. So all of this is our homelands. And today, we live on reserves. And this has been heavily urbanized. Development has really impacted as well as many other impacts I'll get into, but we're now like a small area there. It's about 154 acres of land that we now live on, and we have a couple small islands out here and a sacred island in the harbor. So our land base is hugely impacted as an urban area, and I'll just get into a bit more about that. So we have a very diverse ecosystem in our ancestral lands, our homelands, and this is just one of many. And this one I'm talking about in particular and focusing on one particular part of it, because it's a part of the whole indigenous ecosystem as a whole, is important for this particular trade item, which is known as Gualal or Camas, as it's known in English. These are the indigenous ecosystems known as the Gary Oak ecosystems. And the area that I was showing in Victoria, there was a lot of there historically before colonial impact over 150 years ago. A lot of what's now known as Victoria, there was a lot of Gary Oak ecosystems. Now it's way less than 5%. It's probably even less than 1% of our ancestral homelands. So it's been hugely impacted by many things, which I'll get into, but this is the indigenous ecosystem. So up here, this is one of the areas that we're going to get into about where we worked within alliance with the University of Victoria and Pam Tudge, as looking at different ways that we can work together in addressing some of these issues. And so here we are with some of the elders from different nations that are coming together, and we're looking at ways to also work together in alliance and protecting these ecosystems, and ways that we can work together between nations as well. So these are nations from the island here that have come down that are Salish. So the Halkaminam and the Wasanich and the Lekwungen people working together towards protecting it. We've done multiple projects together as far as holding indigenous conferences that focused on this particular type of indigenous ecosystem, and creating cultural books for kids and plays with things in our language to teach the youth as well, and getting the youth involved. As you can see here, they come out and don't just do walkabouts with plant identification, they actively get involved in the harvesting and getting involved in removing invasive species, which is another colonial impact. But the indigenous food sovereignty to me is about our role and the land. The ecosystem itself as a whole is a part of, it's there because of what our ancestors did. Our ancestors interacted with that ecosystem for it to be what it is. And we continue that as Lekwungen. And this is a woman's role to manage these indigenous ecosystems. And it's theirs to trade the Kwetlau, the Camas. And this role has been impacted by colonialism and what has been put onto the indigenous people nationwide here in Canada, as far as the laws like the Indian Act and the modern treaty processes, and all these things are heavily impacting our land and our connections to that land, because I still see myself as, that's still all my land. But now there's a whole different land title that's being put in place so that individuals occupy and own these lands, and so development happens, and it just takes over a lot of our homelands, our ancestral lands, through development, as well as invasive species. So really, colonialism is an invasive species, and the settlers have come in and altered our landscape, which is a part of who we are and some of our food resources. So in here, this is one of the areas that is on our reserve, which is on one of the islands I mentioned earlier, where we do a lot of our harvesting and manage traditional management of weeding and burning and harvesting on these sites and pit cooking and celebrating our native indigenous ecosystems and food resources. I thought I'd put a picture of myself so you know I actually work. And this is my little nephew. He was about 2 years old there, and I've been backpacking him through the woods since he's been 6 months, and just talking and teaching about all the different ecosystems, including what's now known as the Gary Oak ecosystem. And this is the one where me and Pam worked on the site at UVic, which is part of my ancestral land where the university is, and it's one of the places that was known for our ancestors to harvest in these areas and have huge celebrations. People from all over, the Nechalneth, the Kwakwaka'wakw, the Haida, everyone came to Victoria, and it was a place to trade. We were known as a place to go to get Kwaklel, which is a very important complex carbohydrate. It's a form of starch. Our indigenous foods are much better for us health-wise, because everything that's introduced contributes to a lot of ailments such as diabetes, these foreign diseases that we never had 50 or 60 years ago. And now we're becoming heavily impacted because we don't have a lot of these traditional foods that have been impacted through all the colonialism and development and everything else and invasive species. So a lot of those are part of the, there's a lot more. That's why I'm saying 15 minutes is just, I'm trying to talk fast here, which is not common for us. This is just something as who we are. So it's something we've always done as Indigenous people and going out and working with our own family because it's a family right. And it's something that's been passed down through family. But community, yes, it is linked. There's that communal right as far as this being an Indigenous ecosystem and a part of our ancestral land. But this particular part of harvesting, such as camas, those are things that are passed down through family. So this was probably about the first huge gathering that we had that was not just family. So this was the whole community that was invited to take part in 2001, where we just had nothing but our Indigenous foods, and we were cooking it in the traditional way, whether it was the marine foods, you know, the fish, the clams, the crab, but also like all of our other foods, like the camas, and invited other nations to come, whether they're Indigenous or not, and whether they were settlers or Indigenous to the land, and they came, and everyone traded food. Everyone brought something that they could bring to the pit and cook and contribute, so people were coming with different food. At this particular one, some people came from the interior with Wapato. So there was a lot of people coming and sharing food. And part of what we really want to do is reinstate roles, which is really still ongoing, but making sure it's going to continue through generations and know that there's going to be the land base for this to happen as well. And so it's reinstating the land and protecting the land, conserving what's left, protecting it, and reinstating parts that we can as far as reclaiming areas that we can as far as all of our Indigenous, as part of our who we are in the ecosystem.
This is Deconstructing Dinner. You're listening to Cheryl Bryce, a Lekwungen woman whose territory exists in what is now the Greater Victoria area on Vancouver Island. Cheryl spoke about how her and Pamela Tudge came together to research how Lekwungen people might reinstate an important food practice within the urban setting of Victoria. Pamela Tudge is also heard in this next clip recounting the 2005 camas harvest on the grounds of the University of Victoria. It was the first time in 150 years that such a gathering had taken place, and it continues to be a lot of work to demonstrate how traditional harvesting practices of camas can in fact improve production and improve the important Gary Oak ecosystems that they're a part of.
It was about 10 years ago when I realized that I'm tired of being run out of parks, what are now called parks, part of our homelands, to harvest our food. And as a little girl, I would go with my grandma, we'd go into the parks, wherever our ancestral lands were, no matter what was there, we would just harvest. And no, and it wasn't just camas, it was other things. We'd strip bark, we'd do what we wanted to in our ancestral homelands. And I got to talk really fast because I got to give Pam some time. But this is part of why I started realizing that I needed to start looking at ways to create alliances. So that we can make sure that these things are going to be there for our future. And as much as that was very, very difficult because the issue of trust is there with between Indigenous and settlers and how we can work together and protecting what's left, reclaiming things, and looking at ways where we can work together. And one of the things that I was really tired of a lot was a lot of these settlers coming to me and asking for my knowledge and asking our community for our knowledge. And the fear of that being appropriated and misused. And looking at ways that this could be changed. And what I liked about what Pam, when she came to see me, she asked, what can I do for you and what you're already doing? And that's how we started creating that alliance. And I'll let Pam talk on her end.
In 2003, what we were looking at is in Victoria, so again, it's very urbanized. So there's very small pockets left of where we can harvest camas from and where we can actually go out and harvest camas, harvest other traditional foods, and also pit cook camas, and also manage. So whether we're weeding or trying to burn or something, there's not very many spaces left. And those that are left are all in parks. So the University of Victoria is unique because it actually has quite a bit of land left in Victoria, and it has camas. And so when we were looking at different places we could harvest, the campus became the spot. One of the big challenges to this in an urban landscape is negotiation. So being able to develop those relationships with who is managing the land right now so we can actually have official harvest, so we can actually have official management, so Cheryl and community members are not having to go in and do it where people are not running them out. And so one of the examples of this was to organize a community-based harvest in 2003, where we did it up on the campus, and we came together, and we negotiated permits, and we negotiated fire protocols, and we negotiated with the UVic administration, which was really difficult, to be able to do this one camas harvest at a pit cook and bring people from various nations, including a large group came out from the actual New Chenoweth nations as well, to be able to have a space that didn't take a lot to get to, like the islands, and bring the elders out to be able to do this, to be able to create that space. And after the camas harvest, which saw about 150 people, and it was a successful event, and a lot of I went through a process of interviews and sort of evaluating the process of what it meant to people. I'm going to shorten the conclusion because one of the things like that Cheryl talked about is a lot of it was New Chenoweth Nation and as well as Lekwungen. Everybody talked about this idea of the impacts. They do not no longer have rights to where their food is. They no longer can get to it, and that's impacting them in all kinds of different ways. But on my side, the settler population was not ready to negotiate camas harvesting in an urban landscape. And we have a long way to go to create those respectful relationships within the settler population so we can engage First Nations respectfully and create those alliances. Sorry.
Pamela Tudge and Cheryl Bryce, recorded in May 2010 in Tofino, British Columbia. Pamela is a student of the University of Victoria's Nancy Turner, a well-known Canadian ethno-ecologist who has spent the past 40 years studying traditional knowledge systems of Indigenous peoples, and who we've been featuring today on this part two of our series, Exploring Ethnobiology. Today's broadcast is archived on our website at deconstructingdinner.ca and the July 22nd, 2010 broadcast. Links to other episodes of this ethnobiology series are linked to from there. In this next clip, coming back to my conversation with Nancy Turner, she speaks about her work today, and she speaks about her responsibility and role to preserve and share the important knowledge that has been shared with her.
I've been working, I guess, as a facilitator more and more for communities and for students, and trying to help assist projects that relate to this field in either food production, food renewal, even language renewal to some extent, because those names of plants and animals are specialized vocabulary that even if somebody can speak a language and converse and say, "How are you today?" it doesn't necessarily mean that they know all of those very specialized terms that are part of the depth of a language. And so having had the privilege of working with elders of two or three generations ago and in recording those names, it's now I feel it's my responsibility to help to keep them going. And I feel that's the reason why people took the time and effort and trouble and to share their knowledge with me. I feel very strongly that I have a duty and a responsibility to them to help to keep that knowledge going and to bring it back whenever it's possible.
Similar to the challenges spoken of earlier by Cheryl Bryce when non-Indigenous peoples seek to access Indigenous knowledge, Nancy Turner spoke to me about those challenges and how she manages them upon receiving and sharing traditional knowledge systems of the Indigenous peoples she works with.
It's really, really important to remember that information and knowledge are power, and that it's not really my knowledge, it's not my information. I always make sure that people understand. And what I do is to try as much as possible to ask permission from the knowledge holders to make sure to check, you know, am I doing the right thing? Is this okay? That's always been so important to me, to ask and to seek advice from the people here and the other people I work with or with their families. And me. I remember very well the words of one elder up in Hatlip in the Lillooet, Tsleil-Waututh country. Go slowly, go slow, make no mistakes. So take your time, do it right, try not to rush, try to check back and just constantly be checking what you're doing. And then when you do share knowledge, make sure that you also share and give the proper recognition and acknowledgement to the people who shared with me, and to be very, very careful. I've learned lessons over time, especially with medicines. That is often very private knowledge, and it's not meant to be widely shared. And so if I'm asked to help with a project by a community, of course, under the right circumstances, it's fine. But otherwise, that's the sort of information where it's okay to say this is an important medicinal plant, but you don't want to necessarily give too much unless you're asked to do that, unless people give you permission to do that. Mm-hmm. With food, even that can be problematic. If it's a food that only grows in some places, like people really don't like to share fishing spots because you know that other people will go in and help themselves.
For the mushroom picking spots.
And the mushroom picking spots or even the good berry patches. Mm. And you need to respect those things and be very careful about that. Mm-hmm. But you can, I think, talk in general terms about how important these foods are to people for their health and nutrition and their well-being.
The University of Victoria's Nancy Turner. That wraps up today's part two of our Exploring Ethnobiology series. Thanks to Nancy Turner for sitting down with Deconstructing Dinner at the 12th International Congress of Ethnobiology held this year in Tofino, British Columbia. You can stay tuned for more episodes of this series featuring recordings from that and a similar conference held in Victoria. Helping close out our show here is the music of Adam Shake from his recently released album Resonance on Sonic Turtle Music. This track was featured on the soundtrack for the film Fierce Light by British Columbian-born and raised filmmaker Velcro Ripper. The film explores the world of spiritual activism, a practice that certainly can draw many parallels with the focus of this series on ethnobiology. Thank you. And that was this week's edition of Deconstructing Dinner, produced and recorded at Nelson, British Columbia's Kootenai Co-op Radio. I've been your host, John Steinman. I thank my technical assistant, John Ryan. The theme music for Deconstructing Dinner is courtesy of Nelson area resident Adam Shake. This radio show is provided free of charge to campus community radio stations across the country and relies on the financial support from you, the listener. Support for the program can be donated through our website at deconstructingdinner.ca or by dialing 250-352-9600.